Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats. This week, we have Angela Babb back on our show. And this time, she has a new and gripping story to tell about what the government might not want you to know about how food stamp allotments are calculated. Harvest Public Media shares the second installment in their farmland transfer series, and Chef D warms us up with some sage advice. Stay tuned. The average age of a farmer keeps creeping up, and as they linger in the fields, beginning farmers have a tough time finding land to start their own careers. In the second part of Harvest Public Media's series on farmland transfer, Madeline Beck explains the many challenges that lie ahead.
Beginning farmers aren't a monolith, but they generally fall into one of two categories: those who want to start small, local, and organic operations, or those who want to stay in the family business and grow conventional crops like corn and soybeans, like John Heaton. He's 26 and sells corn and soybean seed outside Toulon, Illinois. He invited me into his warehouse slash office. But what he really wants to do is farm his own land.
You know, growing up on a family farm, it's what I grew up with, it's what I love.
Just as his father and grandfather did, Heaton is looking for land to rent from retiring farmers. But farmers are hanging on longer, and farms continue to be consolidated, so there are fewer opportunities. One angle Heaton has tried is a database in Iowa called AgLink that connects tenured farmers with beginning ones, potentially to buy or rent land. David Baker runs AgLink, and he encourages beginning farmers to think of renting first.
Land is by far the last thing I want to see them try and take on and saddle themselves with debt for land, because that's the slowest return on their investment.
Baker's database is part of the Beginning Farmer Program at Iowa State Extension and Outreach, and is a little like a dating service. It starts online, but the real connection has to happen in person.
And through several, you know, conversations, because I think communication is the key to this, is that they either decide, no, this probably isn't what I'm really interested in, or they say, I'm still very interested in what you have. I'd like to come and visit you.
There are farmer networks to do this through, too. Large organized groups or a few guys who regularly meet for coffee. But the next step in starting a farm is nailing down the business side of things.
When people come to our program, they tend to be pretty starry-eyed and a little romantic about the notion of farming. And so we do our best to take those rose-colored glasses off.
That's Sherry Doyle with the Angelic Organics Learning Center in Northern Illinois. Her organization runs a course that brings tenured farmers together with new farmers to go over business details, including land acquisition. She says it throws an extra wrench into a farmer's budget.
So when you add on a mortgage to the numbers that you're running, it's quite difficult to make a profit.
That's part of why Doyle stands behind renting first. But for those who are dead set on buying a small local operation, it's also hard to find 10 to 15 acre pieces of farmable land for sale. Large 100 acre properties are hard to break up, and the smaller parcels are attractive to a lot of non-farmers, like retirees and horse owners. Ben Snare and his family faced that challenge and searched for the perfect place for more than a year. They found it outside Beloit, Wisconsin, but even then, there was an issue.
Zoning. It was a big thing that I never really thought of, but it ended up being a really big thing where we weren't even going to be able to put up a greenhouse.
Snare successfully got that changed, but it's notoriously hard to maintain a steady profit with a small farm. So they're pivoting toward more meat production and live events, which gives them a more reliable income, and a farm job when they get too old for heavy manual labor. After he mentions that, Snare chases down a cow in the yard. His 4-year-old daughter, Emma, fills the space.
I just learned a couple letters. O, Oh.
I learned it today. And then Z, but no B.
Emma is already helping the snares transplant onions, and Ben loves watching his baby Hayden around the chickens. There's even a third possible farmer on the way. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
To listen again to either story about farmland transfer, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. It's getting colder outside. Chef Daniel Orr has a nice warming drink to curl up with.
The drink is called Sage Advice. This time of year in the fall, the sage is one of the herbs that's still out there, that's still great. It goes up almost through Christmas, sometimes even into New Year. So it's one of those hardy herbs. And sage is a great herb. I use it in one of my potions. And this is when my employees come in and they've got a cold or they've got the Irish flu or something like that. And they need something to kind of perk them up. And so what we do is we start out with, I'll pull it right up here, some apple cider. We'll just kind of clug that in there. The next thing I'm going to toss in there are a couple cinnamon sticks. And if you want to, cinnamon sticks were probably harvested a year or two ago, and by the time you get them, they're quite stale on the outside. So what you want to do is just kind of break them up a little bit, and that's going to really bring out their flavor, release the essential oils. Next, we're going to do a orange pique, which means it's got some cloves in it. And we're just taking the ends of the cloves and we're piercing them through the skin of the orange. And we're just putting them, spacing them about quarter inch apart in lines. So we're going to plop that in there with the cinnamon sticks. Okay, now we're calling it Sage Advice because it has sage in it. I've got some purple sage from my garden. And we're going to add a couple more ingredients. We've got some ginger, and we're going to put a couple slices of that in there. And we're going to put some turmeric, and I've got some fresh turmeric root. Turmeric is a relative to ginger, and so you'll just kind of cut it the same way. And it's got kind of a carrot almost like aroma to it. And it's known for that real yellow color. It's what gives the yellow color to curry. I'm adding some lemon juice, juice from about half a lemon, and I'm going to add some honey. And if you're looking for the exact recipe, we have it online at eartheats.org. And the final thing that we're going to add is something that you might not expect in a drink, and that is some cayenne pepper. So now we're going to put this on, bring it to a boil, simmer it for about 45 minutes. We're going to give it a little stir. You can serve a little cinnamon stick next to it, and you could finish it up with a little bit of bourbon, brandy, or even some nice rum. And there you go, Kate. Give it a try. See what you think.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's like curling up by a fire kind of drink. That's wonderful.
This is you put a pot of this on about an hour before you have guests coming over. So you're coming over for Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's, and it's going to make your whole house smell like nostalgia.
Warm winter night by the fire. That's what I would call that drink.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Thank you. in Alexandria, Virginia, in a nondescript building between a housing complex and a parking garage, a computer is running a program that decides what millions of Americans will get to eat. The program is run by the Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion, which is housed in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Angela Babb was working on her dissertation when she realized it was a strangely mysterious agency. Associate producer Alex Chambers has her story.
Angela was just trying to do some math. She had been studying the Thrifty Food Plan, which is a model diet the USDA came up with. They use it to figure out how much money you can get each month if you're on food stamps.
So the Thrifty Food Plan was first calculated in 1975, and it's been updated three times since then. Last was in 2006. And it's the result of a really complex mathematical program done in GAMS, a general algebraic modeling system.
The plan has a lot of very specific numbers in it. Let's say you're a woman between the ages of 19 and 50. According to this plan, you can get all your nutrition for a month for $164.80. That's 20 cents more than if you're 14 through 18. 20 cents. A month. That is very specific. Angela wanted to know how they figured those numbers out. It seemed like it shouldn't be too hard.
First, I had to get my department to buy GAMS. It's a pretty expensive program. And then reconstruct the calculation based on what's in the final report, the 2006 report out of the USDA. On one of the last pages, it gives the algorithm.
She put in the same constraints that the USDA used, things like commodity prices and food and dietary standards for different ages and genders. And it didn't work. No matter what she did, she couldn't get the same numbers as the USDA. Even when she went to D.C. to ask the people who ran the original calculation. In the end, it took a Freedom of Information Act request to get the numbers she needed. But we'll get to that. I want to start by explaining why she wanted to know in the first place. The USDA presents the Thrifty Food Plan as a diet that low-income Americans can follow to get their basic nutrition. The assumption is that to do the calculation, researchers start with the basic nutritional needs of a human being.
And then the lowest cost diet based on those nutritional guidelines is determined.
But that's not actually how it works. The Thrifty Food Plan started in the 1970s when someone sued the USDA, saying people couldn't afford a nutritious diet on the food stamp allotment.
So the USDA decided to use a mathematical program to prove that that budget was indeed enough for people to purchase a nutritious diet.
Instead of basic nutrition being the main constraint, it was the budget.
And the calculation was basically to determine, can people purchase a nutritious diet at the budget that we've already set?
They used the calculation to find a diet that gets as close as possible to basic nutritional standards within the budget they've already set. The key words are as close as possible. It doesn't actually have to meet those requirements. Just get close.
So the mathematics, what happens is the cheapest sources of nutrients get prioritized in the calculation so it can solve. And what we've done to subsidize dairy and what we've done to fortify milk as well makes it a relatively cheap source of some nutrients and particularly protein. So that the Thrifty Food Plan, the current one, includes over 3 servings of liquid milk, low-fat or skim, for almost all age sex groups, which is extremely problematic when 1 in 4 Americans are lactose intolerant, and that rate goes way up for communities of color.
As we discussed on last week's episode.
But then also in the calculation, there's this assumption that, and it's buried deep in the mathematics, that folks are spending more than 2 hours a day, 2.5 hours a day, cooking these recipes, cooking everything from scratch, basically. But we know that folks are spending more like 30 to 40 minutes a day on average. So there's this very unrealistic expectation for folks that are experiencing time poverty as well to have 2 to 3 hours to prepare all of their food in the home. It's very unrealistic. So We expect these folks to be very thrifty, which is an obnoxiously cute term for a program that's not cute at all. What I've been doing in the Critical Food Studies lab here is calculate different diets based on special dietary needs, like lactose intolerance, like for women who are pregnant or nursing who need more calories, for folks who have diabetes and have to limit their carb intake and overall calorie intake. We've been calculating those minimal cost diets, and they are, especially for women, they are above the budget of the Thrifty Food Plan. So what that's telling me is that this budget and the diet underlying it is not flexible enough for a lot of Americans.
So there's all these problems with the plan that result from the calculations. Problems that have to do with kinds of food people should be eating or want to eat. Problems with how hard it might be to buy the foods at the cost the plan expects. And problems with how much time is realistic for people to spend cooking. But there's another problem. One that you might say gets at the foundation of democracy itself. And that's the secret at the heart of these calculations. See, whatever Angela thought about the results of the calculations, she figured she should at least be able to reconstruct them.
One of the fundamental principles of science is that you should be able to recreate the study and get the same results.
But she couldn't. So she figured she'd just ask the folks at the USDA how they'd gotten their results. She called Mark Leno at the Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion. He was involved with the Thrifty Food Plan updates in 1999 and 2006. I'm going to let Angela tell the next part.
So Mark on the phone said he'd be happy to meet with me and introduce me to the team working on the Thrifty Food Plan. And I let him know I was on my way out to D.C. in a couple of weeks. I'd made all my reservations. And he asked me to send him a little information that he could just share with the team so they knew who was coming and what questions I was going to ask. So I sent my study information sheet. And his response to that was when I called, I didn't hear anything, and I called to follow up the week before I was set to leave and asked if it was still okay for us to meet and talk. And he said that based on my study information sheet, my research was more formal than he had realized, and that he had to have it cleared by the public information officer. And that's about when she reached out to me via email and said, we don't comply, we can't comply with this research, we're not going to do interviews, and if you have any further questions, you bring them to me. And I tried to communicate with her that as the public information officer, she probably didn't have the answers to the mathematical questions I had. And then she proceeded to send me all the same public reports that I already had. And that was literally the week before I left for DC, and I wasn't about to cancel my trip and my housing and everything. So I went out there Monday morning. I just showed up at the office to see if maybe Mark would have lunch with me, or, you know, I could find a way to just chat with somebody in the center. And I didn't get past the security on the first floor. And that's about when they called up to the center's office. I don't know what floor they're on in that building. And they said they were checking a few things and they'd get back about a half hour later. Finally got a call down to the first floor security desk from the public information officer, who was upset with me and told me that I still wouldn't have access to the people in the center to interview them and that I should leave. Once I got rejected by the current members of the center, I started reaching out to people that were previously in the Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion. And there was one who I got a hold of on the phone, and I asked her, why would I be blocked from talking from members of the current Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion? And she suggested that it was a misunderstanding of me as maybe a journalist or reporter, or somebody trying to influence the calculation itself. And the public information officer's job was to make sure that there was no political influence on the calculation or even anything that looked like it might be a political influence. And so I posed a threat in that regard. I was just trying to understand the mathematics that weren't captured in the public reports so that I could run the algorithm myself, but also make sense of all the manual adjustments they were doing.
Okay, cutting back in here. Those manual adjustments are the key. Angela couldn't get the calculation to solve the way the USDA had. And she couldn't figure out why until another scholar, who had also studied the Thrifty Food Plan, told her about the manual adjustments.
So for instance, for females age 14 to 18, they increased the allotment of meat products to 40 times current consumption levels. And there's no explanation of why this is done. There's changes to green and orange vegetable consumption, sodium intake, the vitamin E and potassium requirements, pages and pages of adjustments that someone on the Thrifty Food Plan team was doing in order to just get the program to solve.
But no one would tell her what they were, which is why she had to drop a FOIA on them. That's a Freedom of Information Act request, which legally requires that the agency send her any relevant records that they have. And, incidentally, generally doesn't make them feel any warmer toward the person asking for them.
So I submitted a FOIA request for any and all data they could give me on the calculation, and I got a giant zip file. And eventually I found in there the document that had, I think, 7 pages of the manual adjustments that were done.
And she put them into GAMS, that expensive program the agency uses. I pictured her putting all her parameters in and pressing a big red button to run the calculation. It whirs and clicks, and then spits out the result on a piece of ticker tape. But she showed me the program, and it's way more complicated than that.
The Minnow Solver reports will tell you what parameters are constraining the solution, whereas the Conant Solver reports will tell you what parts of the algorithms, the different, basically which algorithms are constraining the solution.
Okay.
That's the best way for me to explain it. Okay. I don't know. So I still just like don't understand why they're doing it this way, but
really?
Yes,
that's so funny.
They're just, and I'm a person that makes things complicated, but they really make things complicated.
Wow.
With this, like, don't, it doesn't have to be this way.
In other words, it's pretty obscure, and that's just the math. There's also that 10-story building in Alexandria and the security guards and the cranky public information officer. You can kind of see why the USDA might not want to encourage Angela's line of questions.
I think that the Thrifty Food Plan is a political hot potato that holds a lot of weight for millions of people. And indirectly, it's reinforcing a very outdated poverty threshold calculation. And that I think the questions that I raised about it were hinting at some of the major failings of the calculation, and that to acknowledge me was to address how problematic the algorithm is. There's nobody talking about the calculation that underlies the food stamp program. I think because it's in this fancy mathematical geometric program that it's really not something that a lot of people comprehend or want to comprehend. And at the same time, food stamps, the food stamp program is so contentious and so controversial that there's so much debate already about how the program operates, about, you know, the work requirements and so forth, that no one gets down to that detail that's hiding deep within it, which is that Thrifty Food Plan.
Whether or not the USDA is deliberately trying to keep it inaccessible, it has an effect.
I imagine if people understood how important the Thrifty Food Plan is and who's calculating it, then the Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion would have a lot more people knocking at their door, having a say about what's going on and who's calculating it and how.
Which is why Angela is working with a team to create a version of the calculation that anyone can use.
What we need is a calculation that is completely informed by public policy, that is transparent and accessible to the folks that it ultimately affects.
Instead of that expensive algebraic modeling system, they're using Excel. Which seems better, because the calculation will be publicly available on a program that plenty of people already have on their computers. Nutrition scientists, scholars, policymakers, and anyone else who wants to will be able to check the numbers themselves, see what kinds of food, what forms of nutrition get prioritized. Making the calculation transparent isn't going to just magically fix the Thrifty Food Plan. Transparency won't change the numbers themselves. The plan will still expect young women to consume 40 times the amount of meat they actually eat. On its own, transparency won't make the plan work better for people who are diabetic or lactose intolerant or pregnant. But it would at least let us start talking about it. Because when policy gets written, or calculated, in secret, it's hard to say it's democratic. There's only one problem with Angela's big plan. When you stop running the program in GAMS, so this one will you won't have that big red button to start the calculation.
There is the red arrow.
Oh, hey, it is red.
Thanks to everyone who helps out with the show, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Angela Babb. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. I produce the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com.